4.6 billion.
The Earth forms.
Cambrian.
542 million.
Complex life explodes.
Permian Triassic.
251 million.
90% of species die.
Cretaceous Tertiary.
65 million.
Meteor kills the dinosaurs.
55 million.
Primates appear.
2.3 million.
Pleistocene.
200,000.
Humans appear.
20,000.
Agricultural
250.
Revolution. Industrial Revolution.
60.
Great Acceleration.
The Anthropocene.
Welcome to Generation Anthropocene. I'm Mike Osborne, and I'm here in studio today with Gen Anthro contributor Aaron Strong.
Hi, Mike. How's it going?
It's going well. So Aaron and I recently interviewed Ginny Price, and Aaron, maybe you can help me introduce her.
Sure thing, Mike. Ginny is an activist, a historian, a scholar. You know, she has a PhD in history, and she considers herself an environmental historian, I guess, but she's not like most academic historians that you might hear from. She works with art collectives in Los Angeles, and she started something called the LA Urban Rangers.
No, that's awesome. They're Urban Rangers. We get to that in the interview, but actually, I want to back up because the thing that I know she wanted to talk about and we didn't talk about quite enough is the LA River itself. What do you think of when you think of the LA River? Did you even know LA had a river?
Well, that's the thing. I've been to Los Angeles, but I've never seen the LA River. I figured there might be some water that flows through there, but I've never thought of LA as having a river the same way you think of, you know, St. Louis as having the Mississippi or even Chicago having the Chicago River. You know, these are big cities that you kind of know have this water flowing through them. And I've never thought about that in LA. And when it comes to my mind, I picture, you know, this big concrete canal with a tiny bit of water flowing in the bottom. And maybe, you know, maybe when it's really dry, you have some guys drag racing, you know, down in this basin.
Terminator 2.
Right.
I'm always going to think of Terminator 2. And I'm not sure everybody has seen Terminator 2. I think it holds up. But the scene where they fly off the motorcycle and like there's a car chase scene in the LA River.
Right. Exactly. That's what I think of. I think of this big kind of concrete ditch that, yeah, you know, maybe one day had a little bit more water, but is pretty much dry now.
And this is like Ginny's thing. She has this intense love of the LA River. Well, what is that about? What do you think?
Well, I don't know. She seems to want to, she keeps saying that the LA River is kind of the key to unlocking her vision of environmentalism. And that somehow if we understand what's going on with the LA River and what the LA River could become, that this is the kind of environmentalism that we really need in the future.
Yeah. Well, and a part of what's interesting about that to me is like that you would choose a river in a city where the river has been forgotten. You know, like there's something about organizing around community that I think is a part of why she wants this river to resurface, you know, to be visible again.
I think part of it is that, you know, getting to know Ginny a little bit, she's someone who really wants to push buttons and be out there and kind of challenge people's conceptions of what this is all about. And so by choosing the LA River, something that people don't even think about, don't even know exists in a city that everyone knows about, I think there's a little bit of that. But, you know, you mentioned community and this idea of community. And I think that, you know, for her, she is really an activist with the project here. And she wants to build communities that make decisions. And that goes beyond just the kind of...
That sounds so boring.
Yeah, that sounds really boring.
I mean, not to knock it. It's just like, hey, let's all come together and make decisions. But
right, but there's something else here besides just, oh, kind of the hippie dream of, oh, kumbaya, we're all going to get together and make right. decisions. Her vision that she espouses is one where there still are cars. There's still concrete. There's some lawns and stuff. It's not just this idyllic world that people, you know, everyone kind of knows that's not really going to happen, that maybe we aren't going to really achieve this, you know, utopia of greenness. You know, that really comes out in her talking about the river.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, the other thing we touched on a little bit in the interview that I wish we talked about more is her blog. Because what is the, we get to it near the end of the interview.
Green Me Up JJ.
Green Me Up JJ. Can you tell us a little about Green Me Up JJ?
Yeah, so it's a satirical environmental blog. And what happens is she writes advice column type answers to people who are writing in, these are fake people that she's making up, but people that are writing in and saying, you know, how can I'm a hitman and I want to, do my job, but do it in a more environmentally friendly way. And right. she just writes these sarcastic comments that get to the core of, I think, what the problem she's diagnosing in environmentalism today is.
Part of the core to me of that is the humorlessness of it. And I thought we touched on that too. And she's got, I mean, if nothing
she's
else,
funny. She's sarcastic and she brings some humor. And, you know, yeah. as she, I think at one point she was saying that, you know, Jon Stewart and all these guys on the on Comedy Central, Jon Stewart and Steve Colbert, they'll touch, you know, politics, religion, race, 9/11, terrorism, right. and they'll tear it to shreds, but they barely make fun of environmentalism. And yeah. and if they do, it's not in a way that really cuts to the core of it, because people don't think this, you know, whole idea of what we're doing in the planet is funny, but it's got to be. You know, it's got to be approachable, right? And I think Jenny brings that humor to it.
Amen. Well, this awesome discussion, and let's get to it.
All right. Jenny, welcome to Generation Anthropocene.
Thanks so much. It's great to be here.
Okay, before we talk about why you want all of us environmentalists to stop saving the planet, as you say in your forthcoming work, let me ask you another question. What is an urban ranger?
Well, a Los Angeles urban ranger. I think there are urban rangers all over the country, but what we do is we're an art collective, and I'm Ranger Jenny. We use the park ranger persona to engage issues in people's everyday environments. So we take all that curiosity and wonder that people take out to Yosemite and Yellowstone about, oh, how does the world work? What's the geology? What's the natural history? And we bring that into the places that people tend to take for granted and not ask questions about. So we look at places like Hollywood Boulevard and downtown Los Angeles and public access on the Malibu beaches and things like that.
Do you wear a ranger outfit?
We have ranger uniforms. We're very serious about our ranger uniforms. Tails always tucked in. They're always nice and neat. We have the big hats. We also have our summer uniforms.
That's awesome.
Yeah, it's pretty awesome.
So why are you doing this? What are you trying to accomplish being a ranger? I get it's kind of fun to go out there, but why do it?
Well, we're kind of, I mean, I think about a lot of my work as sort of being like what Jon Stewart does, right? Like, we're having a lot of fun and we're playing and we're trying to be funny, but at the same time, the purpose is utterly serious. So the urban ranger, actually, it turns out, engages a lot of the issues that I engage through other formats, like as a writer or as a tour guide. And what we do is we really want to get people to ask questions and to engage these kinds of questions about, you know, where is nature? Where do you find nature in the cities? What do you want your communities to look like? What is the status of public space in Los Angeles? But the way we do that is performative. Say if we're working on the LA River as a public space. Now, I give tours of the LA River as me, not as Ranger Jenny, without the hat. And there I pretty much take people from site to site and I lecture them and I tell them how important this is, that it's actually a river, even though it looks like a concrete sewer. It's really a river and it's a major public space. When we do an event as Los Angeles Urban Rangers, we leave all the lecturing kind of in our notes and in our preparation, and that experience is experiential. We create a kind of almost a story that people can inhabit, where they can actually experience the river as a river and as a public space. So I think what all of these groups are doing, there's wonderful groups out there, Fallen Fruit, Finishing School, all kinds of groups. We're reimagining our connections to nature and each other, but we're doing that by actually experiencing our connections to nature and each other and often how we would like them to be.
Part of your answer there, I think, mm-hmm. relates to this sort of redefinition of nature. And so I'm hoping we can back up and talk a bit about maybe a brief history of environmentalism and environmental activism. Mm-hmm. Can you give us some sort of bullet points, historical context, and sort of where we are now? Because I want to return to the LA River in a second.
Yeah, I mean, I think I'll what I would do is maybe look at what I focused on in the history of environmentalism, which is this idea of nature, which pretty much I have ended up focusing on for my entire professional life since and during graduate school. It's not really my intention, but I keep coming back to it because I think our ideas of nature in this country, you know, American ideas of nature, historically have been some of the most powerful ideas and most unquestioned ideas and taken for granted ideas that we have. And they're very, very difficult to challenge, and they've been very, very problematic. So I think that environmentalism in this country has long been rooted in this idea of nature as something that's out there. It's a refuge. It's not human. It's the world that was here before us, the real world, right? The world that doesn't change. it's basically the place you go to, you know, assuage your anxieties about modern life. And it's been, I think, a problem for environmentalism because for a long time, say 20th century environmentalism was really rooted in this idea, and it was really the heart and soul was really wilderness preservation. About, well, then, oh my God, we have to preserve these places. We have to preserve this thing called nature. So environmentalism, I think, has, for through the 20th century, the critique now has been that it has focused far more on how to preserve a nature out there, which has allowed us to ignore the nature that we actually inhabit in here. And that's been hugely problematic in ways that I think a lot of us are now working to change and to enact a shift.
So my question is it possible to do both? I don't quite understand why we would need to give up the idea of preserving, you know, big swaths of open spaces and these mm-hmm. beautiful wilderness places that are so wrapped up in the American identity, as you say, in order to also say, hey, nature's here in the LA River. Why can't mm-hmm. can we do both?
Yeah, I mean, just look, I'm a baby boomer. We always like to have everything, right? So I think that this critique provokes a lot of fears and anxieties. And this is definitely one of them. Like, oh my God, that means we don't have to preserve wilderness. And I think it's exactly the opposite, that when you define nature more along a spectrum, rather than as a dichotomous thing, like it's either nature or it's not nature, if you define it along a spectrum, like, okay, this piece of paper is nature transformed, and that tree is nature untransformed, and then there are all kinds of states of nature in between, then I think that's much more useful because you can really figure out, you know, how do we inhabit this place that we call nature? How do we use nature as resources? I mean, nature isn't something that's out there. It's actually at the very foundation and core of who we are and what we do and how we create cities. We make cities out of nature. We make our economies out of nature. We make our lives out of nature. So the problem with ignoring all of that is that it actually ends up putting a lot more pressure on wilderness areas. And I think it becomes a real problem for wilderness preservation. And in order to have sustainable cities, you have to have wilderness areas as well for all kinds of reasons. But if you can redefine nature so that you're taking care of your relationships to nature where you live, and you realize that part of that is to actually preserve wild places both in and outside of the cities, then I think it's a much more powerful way of thinking.
I think the example of the LA River is a really interesting one because LA is, well, I don't know. I think about the LA River and I think about Terminator 2 is the first thing that leaps to mind, and the concrete structures, yeah. And you know, and to use that as a case study, also because LA is such a place that feels like, from the outside looking in, that nothing existed beforehand. That it's a blank landscape. It's a canvas mm-hmm. on which to paint whatever yeah. sort of city life nature we want. So maybe you can talk a little bit more about what the LA River represents to you.
First of all, the LA River is absolutely one of my favorite places in the world.
How is that? Elaborate
well,
on that.
I've totally fallen in love with it, but maybe I should, you know, back up. And I think you're absolutely right that Los Angeles really, like many ideas, American ideas, sort of takes the best and the worst to extremes. And we, from the beginning, have said, well, LA is a desert, right? And we've, exactly what you said, Mike, we paint our dreams onto it. And it's been considered to be this kind of empty landscape on which we can invent the American dream. Of course, that's ridiculous. It's not a blank landscape. It's a landscape with a very particular ecology, with very particular people who live there and who have lived there in the past. And by ignoring all those connections to nature and each other, we've created a city that is probably the most problematic city in the country. And one of those ways is to really kind of dramatically ignore the ecological facts of the place, you know, in terms of the way that we build the city. And what probably the most significant example of that is that we took our river. LA exists because of the Los Angeles River. It's one of the best sources for water in all of Southern California. That's why LA is there. And we took that landscape and we took that river, kind of the central artery of the major watershed that the city inhabits, and we basically disappeared it. You know, we turned it into a concrete sewer and degraded it ecologically, but then we also made it invisible so that we no longer even understood that we live on a river. So I think for me, the LA River is one of the best examples that I can think of anywhere for the costs of making nature invisible where you live. Because paving and burying the LA River is deeply implicated in most of the problems that Los Angeles is notorious for, whether social or environmental or economic, is deeply implicated in our thirst for everyone else's water, you know, where we draw water from, I don't know, at least three different watersheds all over the West, major watersheds. It's deeply implicated in our absence of park space, which is a huge social justice issue. It's deeply implicated in air pollution and water pollution. So all the problems that people point their fingers at LA for, erasing our river is actually kind of deeply involved in creating the city that everybody shakes their heads at.
I'm curious, in shifting this conception of nature, as you've described it, do you think we should be making decisions differently? And what I mean by that is, you've talked about how we need to inhabit nature and not see it just as something out there to protect or other from humans, and how cities are part of nature. But, you know, when I hear the words inhabit nature, I think, well, what if I'm calling a developer and asking him to clear a lot, to pave a parking lot, dam a river? You know, this is part of what inhabiting means. And you talked about that. You mentioned people need to use nature. And so in changing this conception of nature, does it change the ways in which you think we should make decisions about what's sustainable? I mean, if we're changing the environmentalist project so it's not about preserving anymore, it's about inhabiting nature, does that in any way change what someone who called themselves an environmentalist, how they would want to make a decision?
You know, I think that we have to stop being, I mean, this was certainly a lot of my autobiography. I started out as a real wilderness girl and a nature girl, which is really my kind of religion. So I'm almost like the equivalent of a lapsed Catholic, you know, now that most of my career has actually been spent tearing down my childhood religion. And I have to say, in graduate school, that was an enormously confusing and troubling time, actually, when I was coming to grips with these ideas. But I think for me, you know, a lot of it was that we have to stop being uneasy with things like parking lots. Parking lots are not in and of themselves bad, right? We live in a world in which we need parking lots. They're not the destruction of nature necessarily. They're not the nemesis. They're not evil. So the question is not so much whether we're going to have parking lots, but how can we build those parking lots? To me, the interesting question is not whether, it's how. So I think that we have to make our decisions much more complicated. It's not this or that. It's how and how much and who. You know, these are the questions that I think really get lost in the dichotomy of, you know, are we destroying nature? Are we saving nature?
I want to get back to the lapsed environmentalist or lapsed Catholic. What do you mean?
Non-Jewish.
Right. Lapsed Jewish. Then.
No, I'm not lapsed Jew.
Right.
I'm just a lapsed nature girl.
What does that mean? What do you mean when you say that?
Well, you know, I mean, I was very much this idea of nature when I was a kid. That's where I found myself and my identity. I went, my parents, to their great credit, took us out to Colorado every summer, and the first time I ever saw the Rockies, I just was screaming, let me out of the car. I want to climb a mountain. So there's something, you know, in me that I really love wild places.
And it has a kind of spiritual value?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And I really love wild places, and I have since I was very little. And then that became really, for me, those were the places that I thought were the good places. So I go to graduate school to study environmental history. I was actually a biology major. I used to spend all my time at these remote research stations studying birds. And my last semester in college, I was looking for an easy course because all I wanted to do was focus on my senior thesis, which was about this Amazonian bird called a white-winged trumpeter. So I found this history course, which I took pass-fail because I wasn't planning on doing any work in it at all. And I hadn't taken any history. But what had happened actually in Peru while I was studying white-winged trumpeters is I climbed a tree to look into a white-winged trumpeter nest, and I fell 30 feet and destroyed my knee, which really changed my life in many ways and changed my future. And for the first time, I think I began to think that the present is shaped by the past in some way. So I think I was ripe for the study of history at that point. So I went to study with Bill Cronin, which turned out to be a really good choice.
Can you tell us a little bit more about Bill Cronin, just for the listeners who don't know who he is?
So Bill Cronin is one of the preeminent historians, much less environmental historians, and really, along with a few other people, really founded the modern field of environmental history. And Bill has been probably the main voice for the critical voice about this idea of nature. He wrote a very, very famous, in some circles, notorious piece called The Trouble with Wilderness, or Getting Back to the Wrong Nature. So I went to study with Bill Cronin, and I just kept being really, I started looking at this idea of nature historically and as an historian. And all of a sudden, this idea of nature I was learning and I was grappling with was a product of history, that it was appropriate to a particular place and time, and it satisfied, it made sense in the context of a particular place and time. And it wasn't universal. And of course, it was my religion, which religion is all about universal principles, right? And, you know, things that are universally true. And so it was very, very confusing, because it really was, I think, equivalent to being a lapsed Catholic, that, you know, it was eroding away what I had most deeply believed in.
There is basically. No God.
There is no God. Exactly. Exactly. And it took me a while to realize that, because you said it's a spiritual connection, and I would say I still have a spiritual connection to wild places, that this is another fear, I think, about that if you attack this idea of nature, that it becomes, nature just becomes, it's an instrumentalist relationship. And I think that's absolutely not true, that just because we find spirituality in wild places, and just because that is a craving that comes out of living in a particular time and place with a particular set of anxieties and, you know, doesn't, I think, make it any less valid just because that spirituality isn't universal.
A lot of people who get their PhD become academics and teach courses and teach the next generation mm-hmm. of 22-year-olds coming out of college. And you're working with art collectives, you're an activist, you're a mm-hmm. writer. So why is that? You know, when did you decide that I want to take this and be an activist?
Well, I think decide is a generous word. I would say a lot of my career, really starting with my PhD, has been accidental. I mean, I really almost accidentally got a PhD. And I've accidentally co-founded an art collective and, you know, accidentally became a tour guide to the LA River. So, but when I went to graduate school, I had no intention of becoming an academic. But like I said, I wanted to study history and I was graduating. So I ended up getting my PhD, but I wrote my dissertation specifically to try to help me segue out of academia. So then I wanted to be a writer. So I moved to L.A. to be a writer. And
when did you move to L.A.?
Right after I finished my PhD, so 1998.
Okay.
Yeah. Packed up my car pretty much after I got my diploma in the mail. And
I'm not ready to leave the lapsed environmentalist thing yet. It's too good.
My goodness.
Well, I think if the analogy is with religion and with mm-hmm. God in some sense, then isn't it more a kind of testing of faith than it is an abandoning of faith?
Mm-hmm. I guess what I'm really driving at is uh-huh. what does it mean to be an environmentalist, and how has that yeah. evolved for you? How has that definition changed? How has that ethos changed?
Uh-huh.
Are you an environmentalist?
Yeah.
I absolutely am an environmentalist. I'm pretty comfortable with that term. I mean, I think that it can be a dirty word in a lot of ways. I think we've earned that, but yeah.
So what does
it
mean?
I'm fine with that term. I mean, what it means to me is that we are folks who really want to and think that it's enormously important to inhabit the places that we live, which includes the places where we don't live, really, sustainably and equitably as possible.
So I love that, but uh-huh. I don't... You write, stop saving the planet, mm-hmm. and you just said, well, we need to live sustainably and equitably, and I'd say a lot of the people I know that say we need to save the planet would say exactly what you just said. So what's different?
Environmentalism is extremely complicated, and there's a lot of it out there that I have enormous respect for and think is really exciting, and I think that environmentalism has shifted out of 20th century focus on wilderness preservation in ways that are very, very encouraging. But I think ultimately, I mean, just the fact that save the planet is still the mantra, it's very telling that we have the exact same mantra that we had in 1970, and that when people talk about changing light bulbs and when they talk about solar panels, it's all about saving the planet, so which is not about inhabiting the planet. And I think it's all about ultimately, well, we have to say the reason we have to do this and the reason we have to be more sustainable, right, is that we have to save this world that's fragile and that's threatened and that was here before us, the real world. Because otherwise we're lost. And I think it's really, really problematic. What I'm trying to do is is move from the critique of Save the Planet, move from the rhetoric and really look at how the rhetoric moves through in very concrete, specific environmental actions and policies. I think, well, a lot of academics, a lot of the critique of environmentalism is really about how we think and how we have to think differently. And of course, that's always been the environmentalist thing too, right? Like, we got to think differently. First, we have to change our consciousness, right? Which I actually don't agree with. But so
you don't agree with that?
No, I don't think that's necessarily first. I think that the kind of society that you live in creates a certain kind of consciousness. And if you can change the circumstances, like how we actually handle resources and things like that, that's actually the most effective way to change consciousness rather than, you know, having consciousness raising sessions and telling people they have to think differently. If kids grow up recycling, they take it for granted, you know, and they just assume that it's part of what we do.
Could you give us an example of what you mean by how the Save the Planet mantra moves through policy decisions? Because
yeah,
I get
absolutely.
That there's a problem with the mantra and you think, well, mm-hmm. people may be actually thinking in the right ways, but they're still mm-hmm. talking about it like this and imagining it like this. But can you give us an example of yeah. how that plays out in a way that really matters to some of these decisions?
Yeah. And what I'm really interested in doing is exactly that, is really looking at the culture of environmentalism, how people understand what environmentalism is and what it's for, and then how that undergirds what we do in ways that I think are really problematic. So, for example, I think that, I mean, you can take the word save and you can take the word planet, and I don't like either one of them, and I'd really love to get rid of both of them. So if you take the word save, I think that a lot of environmentalism is about saving this fragile, threatened, real world that was unchanging, that it was always here before us, and that historically, nature has always been associated with virtue. This was a great insight of Raymond Williams, which I got to through Bill Cronin's insistence, that nature, once you set nature apart from humans, then it becomes kind of this source for human authority that's apart, you know, and above human judgment. So it becomes sort of the source for truth and authenticity. And so what could be more virtuous than protecting that nature, right? So nature historically has always had this incredibly tight connection with virtue. So I think what we see, if you really bring that to the ground and connect it to light bulbs and solar panels, what we see is that being an environmentalist is, first of all, there's an incredible emphasis on individual action and what you personally can virtuously do to save this environment. And first of all, that's created an incredible overemphasis on the importance of individual action to the detriment of actually focusing on systemic solutions and on policy and on regulation so that actually make changes that benefit everyone. But I think it's also gotten very tied up with green consumerism, because how do you actually do this? How do you actually act and become this virtuous person? And I think so often now being an environmentalist is more about being a virtuous person than actually doing something that's environmentally effective. Well, you buy things. You buy green products. That's how you do it. That's how you be a virtuous environmentalist, right? So we have this just, you know, effusion of green consumerism, which makes very little sense at all, really. You know, the other thing I haven't addressed, which has really become the focus of my work, is that I think it really underpins this class divide, which has long haunted environmentalism, really, from the beginning. And that I've really come to see as the biggest problem that we have in terms of making progress on the things that we need to make progress on and cleaning up the big messes that we have out there. So, for example, you know, again, if you really look very specifically at how that works, this over-consumerism, this kind of green eco-porn, you know, green consumerism, okay, in order to be an environmentalist, a virtuous environmentalist, you need to buy green things. Right? You need to live green. However, that can be expensive to do, and not everybody can afford to do that. So the people who can't afford to do that, who are actually the people who have the least impact and are probably contributing least to environmental messes because they don't have the you know, money to use resources, to use energy, they end up not being able to green up their houses. So they are suffering the worst consequences of our messes. They're also living and working in the dirtiest places. And then they get branded as they're not virtuous and they're not environmentalists because they can't green up their houses.
In your discussions of green consumerism, you talked a little bit about light bulbs and some of mm-hmm. these other green products. And to me, when I look around right now, it just seems like almost everything that's about being green is about reducing an impact that's essentially, even if it's not called this, essentially about a carbon footprint. It's essentially right. about climate change. That you know, yeah. what you need to do to live green and sustainably is to lower your carbon footprint. Do you think that the carbon footprint, is that a useful, you know, can we kind of meld that into this idea of inhabiting nature and living in a place? And because it's not all about green consumerism. Yeah. There are parts of carbon footprints that, you know, are really pretty fundamental. And CO2 emissions are part of that real world, you know. Mm-hmm. So,
you know, first of all, I do think that the emphasis on climate change, which I think is an issue that really, while being enormously important, also really fires up the imagination in some ways and also really fires up antagonisms. Because of the same reasons, but
antagonisms. What do you mean?
The class antagonisms that are out there, I think, probably erupt most strongly around the issue of climate change, is what we've seen. But I think carbon footprint. It's almost a little too specific. Like, you can't ever measure your carbon footprint. That's absurd. You know, that's absurd. I mean, maybe the impulse is good to really think about, you know, where all that electricity comes from and all that. But the idea that you could really measure carbon footprint, and I think what's happened is it's become very bound up in this greener than thou kind of culture, where your carbon footprint becomes more important than other things. So you have people who are avowing to, you know, only travel within a 100-mile radius and only use, you know, food from within a 100-mile radius. The fact that their computers are made in China doesn't seem to bother them, and that they're twittering about all they're tweeting. You can tell I don't tweet. They're tweeting about all their amazing, you know, 100-mile radius accomplishments on these computers, you know, every day. But I think that it becomes the ultimate virtue. So, you know, you have people who are writing books about this or blogging about this. They say, well, I couldn't go to my mother's 70th birthday party because she lives 300 miles away, or I wasn't going to get on a plane to do that. And I sort of feel like, seriously? You know, what's more important here? I mean, it seems to me being an environmentalist is about living right in all kinds of ways with each other and with nature, and that when you privilege your 100-mile radius, which to me is actually kind of absurd in this globalized world anyway, to going to something that's enormously important in your family, that's where green virtue has really, I think, gotten out of whack.
I agree that there is a overemphasis on virtue. And one of the things, I mean, if I say to my friends, hey, I'm going to go hang out with some environmentalists, mm-hmm. nobody's going to want to go to that party.
Right. Know? That's going to be boring and righteous.
Yeah, exactly. So I think you're right that there is absolutely a stigma of self-righteousness, and that this carbon footprint thing plays into that. At the same time, climate change is an issue we have mm-hmm. to deal with, and I guess I just don't know where we are.
Well, I mean, I can't give you like the silver bullet, right? But at the same time, I think there's an overemphasis on the impact of individual action, which doesn't mean you shouldn't stop recycling. You know, you should stop recycling. But first of all, don't go nuts. You know, I mean, if you every once in a while you happen to put a glass bottle into, you know, the trash can, it's not the end of the world.
Right.
Like, don't go
10
crazy.
Hail Marys.
Right, yeah. Exactly. You know, it's not the end of the world. And I want environmentalism to be more civic than individual. Hmm. Now, being more civic means civic individuals, you know, as well. But I think it also means working together and looking at, you know, again, where are the biggest messes? So, for example, you know, revitalizing the LA River, I think, great, go get involved in that, because that's going to really make, that's an environmentalism for everyone. It's going to really make an impact for everyone. And when I say, you know, when we say that this connection is greener than now, that, you know, environmentalists are boring, it's not just that they're boring, it's that this has real consequences for how effectively we're able to address our environmental problems. And first and foremost, it's helping to perpetuate this class divide with this greener than thou, you know, which brands the people who actually have the least impact as being the least virtuous. And so, you know, no wonder there are class antagonisms. No wonder working class folks and lower income folks go, you know, environmentalists don't care about us. And they're the people who would most benefit from environmentalism, right? They're the folks who drink the worst water and breathe the worst air and live in the neighborhoods without parks.
Or, for that matter, most vulnerable to climate change.
And the most vulnerable to climate change, absolutely. And so, you know, we need to fashion environmentalism and rethink environmentalism and have a culture of environmentalism that creates policies and actions that are about everyone. And that, you know, right now we don't have an environmentalism that's for everyone. We really don't.
Jenny, you write a blog called Green Me Up JJ.
Or JJ does.
JJ. JJ.
Who's JJ?
Never met her either.
There is a blog called Green
She
Me Up JJ, which
Jenny.
You might know something about this blog called Green Me Up JJ, but in it, there's this letter from a hitman who wants to know how to, you know, essentially reduce his environmental impact. And, you know, they always have to throw away their guns and et cetera. And in your response, you say, well, if you're tearing apart one family, you just have to make sure that somewhere else you're keeping another family together so that your impact is balanced out.
And, right. That makes sense, doesn't it? For every homicide that you commit, you need to make enough donations to the Brady Campaign to prevent gun violence to prevent a homicide. If you prevent more than one homicide, then you can actually save lives by murdering people. That makes sense, right?
There's some logic there, yeah.
There's some logic there.
What are you trying to do with this blog? I love it. I encourage everyone to check it out. You know, you talked a little bit about how you wanted to be a writer for Jon Stewart, and I see all of that in this. Yeah. But so what are you trying to do with this, work?
I'm trying to advise people like hitmen who are really struggling to understand how they can be virtuous environmentalists. So basically, I actually haven't posted one in a long time. I'm hoping to get back to it this summer. But I decided to experiment with a satiric column because there are all these columns out there like Ask Umbro, which actually give quite good green advice, right? And I thought it would be fun to use a satiric column to try to do the same critique that I've been doing. So I engage exactly the issues I've been talking about, the connection of nature to virtue. So the idea being that it doesn't matter if you kill people as long as you recycle, that's fine, you know, because that's the ultimate virtue, and that you can trade as a way of critiquing the concept of trading. Talk about it in terms of homicide. But the problem with this, I'm having a lot of fun with it. It's a difficult thing to do. And I also think, to me, it's enormously important to use satire and irony and humor in environmental issues because the connection historically between nature and virtue has meant that there has been a certain lack of humor.
There's a humorlessness
to
the virtue.
Yeah, there is a humorlessness and sincerity.
It's too precious.
Yeah. It's almost like if you watch Stewart and Stephen Colbert, they very seldom take on environmental issues. I mean, Osama bin Laden apparently, by all accounts, is a lot more funny than, you know, a lot funnier than climate change because people don't laugh about environmental issues. So they say, well, that's not funny. You're like, okay, well, you know, The Onion made jokes about 9/11. So really, we can't make jokes about climate change? So the problem with this is I thought this would be a great way to use irony to attack this greener than thou kind of culture. And Richard White, who I know has been on this program, when I showed him some of the early ones, he said, well, you know, they're not going to get that you're being funny. And I was like, how could they not understand that I'm being funny? I'm saying that you can save people's lives by killing people. I mean, how can you not understand that I don't mean that? So I put this blog out there, and that hitman one, in fact, a couple of the responses I get is, first of all, people have on many more than one occasion said, so did a hitman really write you? I'm like, yeah, a hitman wrote me and asked me how to, yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
But, you know, there's this, like, and then the other thing that's happened is I had one person say, you know, what I really love about this column is I think it's really important because it shows that you can have guns and also be an environmentalist. I was like, you know, that really wasn't my point. So I sort of felt like, my God, Richard's been vindicated. Yeah. You know, there is an inherent built-in flaw in using satire to do this critique in that there's nothing you can do, apparently, to get people to get this and to think differently. Really, I mean, it's almost a hopeless crusade. This idea of nature is so powerful and so ingrained and so difficult to get people to think differently about it. And I sort of feel like, God, if I can't do it with the hitman column, I'm not even sure what to do at this point, you know?
Yeah. Well, Dr. Jenny Price, thanks so much for coming on the show today.
Thanks a lot for having me. It's been fun.
Thanks for listening to this episode of Generation Anthropocene.
We want to thank our guru, Tom Hayden, as well as Maxine Luckett for all their behind-the-scenes work.
Special thanks to Pam Mattson, the Dean of Stanford School of Earth Sciences, and a very special thanks to Maserati for letting us use their song, Monoliths.
We also want to thank KZSU Stanford 90.1, where most but not all of our interviews are recorded.
You can find past episodes on our website, anthropocene.stanford.edu, where you can also submit a story idea of your own.
Follow our conversation on Twitter, @GenAnthropocene, or like us on Facebook.
I'm Mike Osborne.
I'm Miles Traer.
And I'm Leslie Chang.
History is accelerating, and you're a part of it too. Welcome to our new geologic age.